Hello, and welcome to Movies We Dig, the podcast about film, antiquity, and everything in between. I'm Christy Vogler.
I'm Elijah Fleming.
And I'm Colin McCormick.
And today, we're chopping up Xena: Warrior Princess, an American fantasy television series that ran from 1995 to 2001, created by Robert Tappert, RJ Stewart, and Sam Raimi, and starring Lucy Lawless. And today, we have a very special return guest. We have Amy Pistone from Gonzaga University, who is going to just nerd out with us about this 90s cult classic. So, Amy, welcome back. Glad to have you.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be back. This is really exciting. As I told you all in advance, this was such a good excuse to buy the entirety of Xena, the entire catalog of every episode, and just binge so much Xena. So thank you for that.
So something tells me then that you do, in fact, dig this TV series. Do you want to tell us, like, you know, what was your first time watching the show? What's your background with it? And why do you dig it?
Yeah, so I definitely dig it. I forgot that was a question you asked. But yes, I do dig it. And so I didn't watch Xena when it was on originally. My partner watched Legendary Journeys of Hercules, which is like a complicated history now with Kevin Sorbo's politics have taken a real turn. Yes. And so like there's a lot of nostalgia wrapped up there. And I never watched Xena or Hercules growing up. And so it was not until I think grad school that I watched any Xena at all. I don't have the nostalgia per se, but I love this show so much. Like, it's so campy and it just really makes me very happy. And yeah, I have so many specific things I'm really excited to talk about. But yeah, for the most part, it's campy and it deals with stuff that I love. And I've dressed up as Xena for Halloween. And I love everything about this.
I was actually very kind of surprised to hear that you were not a Xena, like, or from the get-go, or didn't watch it when it was coming. Because I sort of, if I had to guess, I would have sort of supposed not to profile you too hard, but...
What are you trying to say? I'm a queer classicist who likes badass stuff. I'm personally very offended.
Yeah, none of those around. Because I think for like Eli and Christy and I were like, it's a little like, I think I just missed it. Like, I remember it being on, but I didn't necessarily watch it myself all that much.
I'm definitely the right age to have watched it on TV. I just, my parents had strong opinions about what constituted like worthwhile television viewing, and it was mostly PBS, like a lot of PBS, and Animaniacs for some reason was also, but it was also like educational programming. And this, while I would argue that this is actually educational programming, this did not make the cut. So, and then, you know, for a while, it just wasn't easy to get things on demand. Like, you had to have a box DVD set or whatever. It just wasn't as easy to get things on demand. And in grad school, Xena was actually available for streaming. So it was much easier. Like, it was somewhere before all the streaming rights changed around a million times.
Because right now it's kind of tricky to find. I won't say where I found, where I watched most of my Xena, but I think you're right. Like, I remember, I think in college or graduate school, going back and watching some on Hulu or Netflix or something. But now it's kind of in a weird...
It was somewhere for sure. And now it's like impossible to, I ended up just having to buy like on, you know, Amazon or whatever, just buying all of them, which is a worthwhile investment. But I think
where was it originally? I don't even know.
Oh, like what network it was on?
Yeah.
I don't know. Look at us doing our research in advance.
Truly, right?
I've got the Wikipedia open and
I couldn't find it. And I guess maybe I just missed it.
It was distributed by MCA TV.
Whatever that means,
Okay. Universal. So it might be in like a weird rights limbo, which might explain. It was on NBC.
Okay.
It was one of those single digit channels, like 8, 9.
Yeah, it was like very like network. You know, you didn't need fancy stuff to watch it. Yes. It was like on the TV that you could get with normal TV things.
Because I remember as a child, like seeing it on TV randomly. And being like, this is awesome. I want more of this. But having like no concept of how to find it or get more of it myself as a small child.
It's slot, because also it had a 9 o'clock slot, which would be why probably when I was 9, I wasn't watching it, right? Because that was just because I think Hercules was on at 8, Xena was on at 9. And so that would be like my parents would probably put us to bed and then they would watched. And so like that was my Xena is like one of those shows that like Star Trek that lurks in my memories of like my parents watching it and I'm just like floating around the background somewhere.
Well, that played such a role in like what shows. Yeah, because we would one of the other few after saying that we didn't watch any normal show. My parents did really like watching Home Improvement. And so like I would watch just the first opening like stand up
problematic lead actors.
I know. Yeah. But like watching just the little opening bit of Seinfeld, but like not after the first commercial break, like just the little stand up-y bit at the beginning. And yeah, that was back when how the lineup was set, like really mattered what you were watching. You wouldn't, you didn't tune in for a show that you could just watch streaming and then move on with your life. Like, oh, yeah. Well, this is on after this and before this. So I watched those shows was really a factor. So yeah, this was definitely, it was on after Hercules. And so older kids, you know, who stay up later or like parents could watch Xena, but it was getting a little late for some kids' bedtimes.
Christine and I, were you always Xena heads or what, when did you get into, if at all?
Nope. Same as like, I know it was there and I definitely saw a few episodes, but this time period, Wishbone would also do stories. So yeah. Like, that's what I reconnect with Greek myth in my television viewing. It's not
like the
so
Homer
much.
Sweet Homer, where yes. He's Odysseus and he has to like pull the little bow back with his tiny little puppy.
Yep. So that was like, I was obsessed with Greek mythology at the time, but for whatever reason, this just... And I'm sad now because I started watching it. I'm like, oh my gosh, I would have loved this had I been like more cognizant. I know I saw Hercules. I saw some young Hercules, but like.
Well, that is the one that I'm, which I didn't realize until like today that young, the Ryan Gosling young Hercules is also a spinoff of Hercules with the Kevin Sorbo one. I mean, they're like very much of a, I just thought they were like peas in a pod. I didn't realize they were actually like genealogically connected.
I never watched.
Ryan Gosling and somebody else is in it too. But speaking of like the whole, the 90s of it all is like one of my kind
I'm
of
sorry,
like talking points.
Where this goes. Speaking of the 90s.
Yeah. Well, it's just like, as I was watching, I find myself and Amy, you talked about this of like, this is a show to my mind. This is a show that could have only come out when it came out. Like television is going to change fundamentally sort of not long after this. As we get into like more prestige television and then eventually into streaming, which just kind of changes the whole landscape utterly. But I was sort of thinking, yeah, of like this is – there was talks of doing a Xena reboot around like 2017. Sam Raimi was in talks and it never came to fruition. But like Xena as a sort of cultural artifact of like late 20th century American pop culture – this isn't a question, like, but like, I guess what I'm asking is, like, could we ever do Xena? Could we ever have Xena again? And like, what would it look the same? What would that be like?
Yeah, I have two thoughts. One, I mean, because we are in such like a rebooty nostalgia era, like, I think you could get a reboot, but I don't think it would look the same. Like, we just don't do unabashedly campy stuff right now. Like, I think that register lives in like reality TV or like. I don't know, professional wrestling, like the kind of unabashedly campy, not the pretending you meant it to be campy when people turn it into memes kind of thing. But like, that's just not a thing that is really in vogue right now. And so I think it's because, yeah, I mean, this strikes me as it's from the same time that like Batman was super like gaudy and campy and all of that. Yeah. It just was a different aesthetic and the kind of a different sensibility. Whereas now, I think if you did a Xena reboot, like it would be so gritty because everyone wants like dark, gritty and like,
It'd be like The Witcher or like
Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon.
I don't like, that's not this show, right? Like this is so like, there's like goofy set, like sound effects and there's silly jokes and there's, it's very much like a cultural artifact of a different era that I don't think. Yeah, you'd have someone with like a very low voice and, you know, she'd kill a lot more people and
desaturate the whole picture. And,
and it's just not like you wouldn't get, I don't know if you guys had a chance to rewatch or watch any of the episodes with Aphrodite, but you're just not going to have this very, which is such a delightful characterization because like it's such a riff on the like Botticelli Venus kind of thing. Like she's born out of the sea and she's like this surfer girl who's very, at a time when Valley Girl was something that had a lot of cultural relevance as like a type. And she is that. And, you know, Carl Urban with like bleach blonde hair as Cupid. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just have to go on a quick digression here. But like the fact that Carl Urban plays two entirely different characters.
Yes.
And they never
bring this up.
He's just like, it's honestly, it's wild when I see an Australian or New Zealand actor that isn't in this show. Like, did you offend someone? Like, off that they didn't call you about this because they were recycling characters. They just had to call Carl Urban every time. Like, we got another role. We have Julius. Can you be Julius Caesar? Like, I'm dying to see an episode where Cupid and Julius Caesar are at the same, and he just has to like frantically be switching costumes and accents and things.
I love it so much.
There's also, I mean, Lucy Lawless in herself, there's like, I think three Xena lookalikes or something like that, like that come
up.
Yeah,
because there's Diana, who's a, and like, I love that the episode titles, clearly I didn't take any notes. I started taking notes and then I just stopped. But it's like Princess, oh, now I'm going to have to look up the titles. But it, like each time they keep like adding another like Princess,
oh, Princess Warrior Tramp.
Like, Warrior Princess Tramp. And then like Warrior, there's like a, they keep like riffing on the same title as like, there's another one. Cause there's Meg who's, and I just like, I just love Xena like doing all of these different accents and like, she's just having a blast. It looks like everyone's having so much fun.
As I was watching him, one of my like takeaways, I'm like, Lucy Lawless is a ham. Like she is really hamming it up.
Which I feel like has kind of gotten lost in some of the, but yeah, the amount of different, especially on these episodes where people are taking over people's bodies and you've got, you know, she's, someone else is taking over her body or she's in someone else's body. And it's just, yeah, like there's silly plots and she's clearly loving it. Cause I feel like the cultural memory of her as Xena is such a, you know, it's like a lot of fighting and like badass, and you know, there's like her ambiguously but definitely queer relationship with Gabrielle, and like all of like that's what we remember, and not how incredibly silly this show. Like the show is so silly, and I think that's one of the things that was such a pleasant surprise revisiting this is like it's so silly from top to bottom, and I love every bit of it.
Yeah, my personal favorite moment was like almost where it went more seriously was the Cleopatra and Antony, but Xena is pretending to be Cleopatra.
Yeah.
And I forget what 90s song it is, but it's like hypnotized, mesmerized by what she, and like it's just her sex, like very sexy eating grapes with Antony. And I'm like, holy cow, this is intense. And so the 90s nostalgia was there in so many ways. The sound effects, like,
it's
like that's what
put my mic just
sounded
there.
Like in the 90s was those sound effects, and oh, I loved it. So I kind of needed to spend more, even more time watching even more. I was just wanting to go back to like Colin's question. It's like, I don't think you can really recreate this as it was. I think it'd be interesting if you got someone who did comedy in some way. So like it's not a perfect fit, but I was thinking like what Mindy Kaling did for Never Have I Ever or something, where it's like have a lot of humor, but still have kind of a serious storyline, but still play with it. Like who's the narrator voice playing with it in fun ways, but it would still be very different than what it was in the 90s for sure.
I'm having a thought about maybe a natural like progression that came out of this that I had never really thought about before, but I see a lot of these storylines like in Supernatural, which also I think tries to be, we're gritty and serious, but they lean into the hamming it up like pretty heavily as they keep going.
Yeah, they very quickly move on from whether this like needs
and
to be
serious.
And
they also do a lot of like clones and like people in other people's bodies and like weird like doubles and like, you know, characters talking to themselves. And I weirdly see that as like the successor to Xena Warrior Princess in a weird way.
To that point is I guess maybe like is testament to like the origin of Xena as like a property, right? Because it's born out of Hercules' legendary journeys, and it sort of is one way in the first season or so, and then kind of like, you know, the difference between Xena season one and Xena season six is it's not, I mean, it's a continuum, but like it's there and it takes a minute for the show to find its footing. And I think Supernatural is kind of like that too, where like once they kind of realize what they're working with, and this is true of all shows, once they kind of like find their pocket. Oh, but also just in just shows like the the creation constraints on were like they've got they're producing 20 episodes a season, 40 minute episodes. The budget only goes so far. So you do get these episodes like, you know, that are very self-contained, or you have multiple actor or an actor playing multiple parts. And I'm reminded of like in Star Trek, you know, right, it has like a similar thing where it's like, oh, we'll do another, you know, holodeck episode or something like that. We'll do an episode that like where we only need the one set, or like we'll just invent some constraint to like, you know, really sort of stretch the budget out as much as we can.
Well, so the episodes, I think it's the end of season one, maybe, or it's anyway, there's a stretch where people die. It's a Callisto part. And then Xena is back, but in Callisto's body, and like trying to figure out a way to get her body back. And I was like, what happened there? And so I like went digging a little bit, and Xena hurt herself doing Lucy Lawless hurt herself doing a stunt. And had like a fractured tailbone or something. So they were like, look, we got to keep going. See if we can get the actress who plays Callisto. And we're just going to, and you kind of, these are not things I noticed at all. But my partner was like, it's like all of the footage of her, like the limited bits that you see of actual like Lucy Lawless, it's all like distant shots and what looks like stock footage. I was like, really? So I went looking and like, yeah, it's, she had to be out for a couple weeks while she was like recovering from a fractured tailbone or something.
Oh my gosh. And
so they were just like, I don't know, what if like we keep having stories, but instead of Xena, it's Callisto, but Callisto acting like she's Xena, who does a marvelous job. Like she's legitimately the actress who plays Callisto does a great job of not being so like unhinged and like, because she's such a good villain. And then when it's Xena, like I was really impressed. I was like, she could channel a whole different, because I think playing someone else in your body has got to be a real challenge for like getting the mannerisms and like the, you know, some of the vocal tics and things. And she crushed it.
Yeah. Hudson Leak. Yeah. And they absolutely, because also at certain points, because Bruce Campbell is Xena at one point.
Yeah.
And so is Ted Raimi.
Bruce Campbell is a national treasure. I knew he could pull that off.
He's the perfect vehicle for a ship, right? Right. You want to talk about like camp.
Because he's such like he's like a delightful B-grade actor. And I love that they let him become this recurring character where anytime someone steals anything, you're like, Autolycus, where are you?
Yep. Now my read is that tracks to me as like kind of the Sam Raimi of it all. Cause like one, like Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi are like high school buddies, and that's they're all in each, you know, he's in all of his movies. And Sam Raimi is that he's a very like exaggerated, he buys into a lot of exaggeration, like essentialism or like camp and that kind of thing. Evil Dead being kind of the obvious. But I'm going farther afield, so I'll stop.
Well, I was going to say how much I enjoy that. Then I assume it's from Xena that Lucy Lawless then gets the call to be in versus Evil Dead.
Oh, and
Spartacus, I assume, you know, that's a genre thing, but just that like she had so much time working with Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi that they were like, we need someone for this TV show. We should call Xena. I bet she'd love this. And she's great. Like she's great in Ash versus Evil Dead.
And we mentioned that it seemed like every actor in New Zealand had at least one part on Xena, and which leads me to kind of like, is Xena kind of responsible for Lord of the Rings in sort of a roundabout way? And just because like New Zealand as a film destination, because they filmed the whole thing in New Zealand. Obviously, Peter Jackson, who gets picked, a big part for him was filming Lord of the Rings in New Zealand. But like in my mind, I was wondering, like, did Xena open the door for Lord of the Rings? But I don't know.
Based on nothing at all, I just like having hot takes. So I'm going to say 100% definitely yes.
Yeah. Okay. we'll just go with that. We won't look into it further.
No follow-up questions. Yes. I mean, it's definitely, I would say like as there are some episodes where the scene, I'm like, this is not even remotely Greek scenery. So like the environment is nothing. And to be fair, I mean, this is one of the things that I did again, before I stop taking notes on stuff I want to talk to y'all about, but how like the show is so unconcerned with time and place at all. Like timelines doesn't matter. Like we're going to talk to Caesar and then we're going to talk to Helen of Troy. And then we're like, it doesn't, Xena can just, it's sort of Forrest Gump-ish. Like she can be at any major moment in Greek history she wants to, or literature that she wants
to. I literally wrote down Xena's like the Forrest Gump of antiquity, like in my notes.
Yeah, she just happens to be everywhere. Like it's fine. Yep. You know, I haven't gotten this far, but I think there's an episode where she defeats Merlin. maybe.
Yeah, there's what she goes, they go to, they, there's an episode with Beowulf.
Like Arthur thing. Yeah. Yeah.
She's responsible for everything involving with Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra. She's like Virgil's step, like, I don't know. Well, like her body double is Virgil's mother, I guess is the way to put that.
It's like a whole new take on the Alexander romances. It's just, yes, like, you know what? Yeah. We're going to roll with it.
Which I love, because I feel like so many times people get hung up on with these like treatments of class of like, oh, well, that's, you know, the timeline's wrong, or the, you know, the shield isn't the type of shield that would have been used in this time period. And for some things, I think it's worthwhile. Like, that's a thing you can discuss. Like, they're going for super historical accuracy on their aesthetic and whatnot. And like, oh, they didn't ask a art historian what the statues would have looked like at that time period or something. But for something like this, that's just fundamentally the wrong question to be asking about what it's doing. Like, it doesn't care. That is not even remotely like how things are pronounced. And, you know, there occasionally will be Kekrops, who is a character that, oh my God, what's his name? He's the Candyman. Shoot, hold on. Tony Todd. There we go. He's Worf's brother in Star Trek. But yeah, so he shows up as Seacrops, who's like a cursed sailor. And like, my brain just can't, because I watch stuff with subtitles on. And so like, I'm seeing it before I hear anyone say his name. And I'm like, oh, it's Kekrops. Seacrops, you say. As with so many, like, it's just these, they aren't things that this show is interested in. And I feel like it's, you know, it's a disservice to be like, oh, it should be that. Like, I don't, the show is doing what it's doing. And sometimes they seem to clearly have talked to people who knew something about history. And sometimes they're just like, I don't know, this seems fun. He's a cursed sailor. And we're going to have our extremely goofy looking Poseidon come up out of the sea and be like, oh, you can't go home now, Zena. Like, that's fine.
Or I remember the one where I think Gabrielle like goes to some school in Athens, and she's for like bard school. And she like has to go up against, what is it, Homer and Euripides, who are also there.
Yeah, it's just like, famed contemporaries. It's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine. I think we all know of the canonical the competition between Homer and Euripides.
Yeah, exactly.
It's on the next scroll after the Hesiod and Homer one. Exactly. I think it rolls exactly right into, and also sequel Euripides.
And I think this was like, what, after they've been at Troy and like hanging out with Helen, but maybe it's before. I love that, like, it doesn't matter.
Sometimes it, like, they kind of give like a vague lip service to like Odysseus, when she meets Odysseus, like, she's worried that he'll be mad at her because she helped Helen. And like, sometimes they feel the need to be like, but here's a relevant detail from before. And other times they're like, what continuity? Continuity, yeah, is for chumps. I've always said that.
Yeah, I watched the two episodes that Colin had recommended for Cleopatra's representation. And like, the first one, it's a biracial, I forget who it was, playing Cleopatra. I'm like, a biracial woman. I'm like, oh, this is amazing. Like, it's a great.
She's on Firefly.
Yeah. And like other, yeah, it took, I didn't know, I'm so bad at recognizing people that. Gina Torres,
that's it.
Yeah,
there we go. Yeah, and it's like, oh, great, that's awesome. And then I skipped to the very next Cleopatra, and I'm like, forget all of that. We're going to do a whole new thing. And like, some of the stock ideas about Cleopatra were kind of like replayed, like both of them having her disrobe and get in a bath at some point. And it's just like, oh, yeah, she's super sexy. And her attendant in the first one was like, so apparently not Egyptian by any way. So it was so hilarious. And then they tried harder the second time, but got a whole different actress who was not biracial that time. So I was like, all right, just, all right. Oh, now Xena's Cleopatra. Well, it's fine then.
And to come back to kind of Amy's point, is like, you're right. Like, to approach the show from the like, you know, veracity angle, which a lot of people sort of doing reception or talking about reception, or even just if you're teaching like a mythology class and you're like, what do you think about this work? And like, you know, people tend to get hung up on the like, how, like the accuracy, quote unquote. And in a certain sense, like, it's very, this show's relationship to history / myth is very impressionistic. It's just, it relies on sort of like, what's your, you know, you, the general audience, American viewership, when you hear Caesar, what do you think of? When you hear Cleopatra, what do you think of, you know, or Homer? And so, and that's really as deep as it kind of goes, I think, which is fine. And I think that's in many ways like the function of a myth, right? Is to build on these sort of like, it's not essential, that's the wrong word, but these kinds of like core ideas. But I was hoping we could talk a little bit just about like, yeah, like it's got a very loose, we'll say, relationship that we sort of people in the know can sort of joke about why Homer and Euripides aren't contemporaneous. But for most people, that's like, like who, you know, does it matter? And then like, what's our, you know, how is this show as like a vehicle for whatever it is, myth or history or religion or anything?
I have two like somewhat, okay, before I have two like actual sort of serious comments on that front, because like this does dovetail with things that I think about a lot for my research. And I like with teaching as well, thinking I'm teaching Greek myth this semester. And so like thinking a lot about like, what is a myth and how do myths function when you're talking about kind of the, you know, there is this inherent fluidity in myth that I think is open to this kind of rereading. Anyway, I just wanted to mention the first Cleopatra episode before I have like a serious point. I was looking up, I just pulled it up on the wiki and was noticing that's the one where Joxer's brother Jet is there and Ted Raimi just gets to play his like evil brother. Because he comes from a family of warlords and like he's such like the disappointing child because he's not a warlord. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure we mentioned that. But thinking about classical reception in broader terms, and how, so I just turned in a draft of an article that is looking at kind of models for classical reception and thinking about the way that these stories kind of are open to being kind of, it's coming, building off a piece that talks about reception as a sort of sparagmos, but like a generative sparagmos, mm-hmm. where a sparagmos being kind of the tearing limb from limb that happens in the Bacchae and, you know, in general, this kind of like ripping someone to pieces, and that you kind of, you know, you can rip these stories into pieces and then, you know, put them back together in whatever way you want. And I think oftentimes we think about like fidelity to the story or like owing something to the story. And I tend, this is not the most nuanced stance and I would caveat this a couple places, but I tend to think you don't owe anything to the story. Like these are people that are long dead and there are ethical concerns with representing people's stories in certain ways, like elides violence or elides whatever. But like at the end of the day, I don't know, tear it up and take what's useful for you. Like you want to tell a story about, I don't know, like Xena single-handedly fights off the entire Persian army. Like, what? Sure, why not? Like, the idea that there is something that's like doing a disservice to the story of history or something about this. Like, I don't know, man. Like, it's like take what is useful to you, and if what's useful to you is the part that lets you tell the story that you want to tell right now, you know, that's a, and I think a lot of people who do, especially with Toni Morrison's use of classical antiquity, the way that it's not a one to, and it's almost like it's oftentimes kind of playing with the reader that, you know, somebody who seems like they're like, they have a classical name and you think they're going to be like an analog for this classical figure. And it's an entirely different character that actually has similarities to Ajax or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that it's, you know, taking what's useful for your ends. You don't owe anything to ancient Athens or Homer or whatever, but like the parts that are fruitful or generative for you, like that's, and so, you know, I mean, what Toni Morrison doing, I would say is somewhat different than what Sam Raimi is doing, but at the same time, like it is this kind of like name, like mining these materials for what is actually useful for you to build something new, as opposed to like, this must be a documentary that recreates the thing exactly the way that Herodotus told us it happened or whatever. Like that's such a limited view of things that you can do with these characters and tropes and stories and things that people kind of recognize. Like you said, like when you think of Caesar, what do you think of? Okay, here's a Caesar character. And now I'm going to tell you the story I want to within this Caesar story that, you know, that we're starting from a little bit of a baseline. I don't have to introduce you to the character of Caesar completely. As soon as you hear his name is Julius Caesar, you have assumptions. And now I can tell my story inside this kind of extended universe of like Greek and Roman stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of it is, I wrote down a little note, but like Caesar's a really good example because when he comes on screen and he kind of, there's a dramatic pause for effect and he says, I'm Julius Caesar, you know, where like the show is leaning on like where he, we don't need to develop this character. The show doesn't feel the need to develop this character, right? We come in with a whole host of sort of baggage and assumptions about Caesar.
Yeah, I kind of have two thoughts on that because I think we've talked about before how when we look at Greek stories versus Roman stories, like one thing that's always really interesting is like Greek reenactments are always seem to be focused on mythology or at least legends. And then Roman stories tend to be more historical in nature. And I like that this is mythologizing both of them because we really, legends were history. They're just passed down orally and you add some flair to it to keep the story interesting. And historical accounts very much are the same way. I have my students read Cortez and the way he writes about his expeditions in Mexico. He is very much creating his own mythology about what is going on. But there was a comment that Colin made of the fact that they are creating the show as a way to like be a touch base for an American audience. It's like, oh, this is what I would know about Caesar or Homer or anything like that. Do you all think that that might result in kind of a white supremacist tone to the show overall? There's a similar critique of the first few books of Percy Jackson, where like it's very influenced by white supremacist ideas that are just the way we have tended to think about and have inherited these stories. So I didn't see enough episodes to see if the tone was in that way, but I was curious if any of you noticed that at all.
I feel like Caesar was cast as the villain, though. And I think in so many more alt-right depictions of Caesar as the Roman hero, he's like the center of the story. And here he's kind of like a big bad that is kind of reoccurring. And we don't root for him. Like he's a great villain, but we're like definitely rooting for Xena to kick his ass.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting, because I think a lot of it feels sort of refreshing in a way, just because things are so politicized in ways that, like, not that it was like, oh, the good old days, the 90s, where there were no social problems, but there wasn't quite the same, some of the depictions, I think, if you did now, in the same way that, like, Captain Planet, I'm sure, would be like super controversial if you tried to make it now, because like the idea of climate change and protecting the environment has become like a really political, like, oh, how dare you? This is such a polarizing issue, in a way that like that wasn't a thing people were mad about in the 90s in the same way. And mm-hmm. I think like a lot of the choices that they make in this show, I think would upset people if it were made, like if similar casting choices were made now, mm-hmm. I think you'd get people talking about in the same way that people get it, like, oh, you can't cast, you know, a Black Achilles or in like a Viking show or whatever, like historically authentic casting. Like, you mean for mythical fictional characters? Yeah. But, like that kind of attitude where people, and I think in some ways it's sort of like, yeah, Gina Torres as Cleopatra, like that would be something that you would see news articles about, how like they're coming for your historical Cleopatra or something. Whereas like it wasn't really a consideration. That said, I think in like a lot more implicit ways, like I think there is sort of the same, because like the thing that jumps out at me, having only read Percy Jackson like 2 years ago or something, my students were like, how have you not read Percy Jackson?
Oh, don't get me started on the PJs.
I really enjoyed it. I like listened to audiobooks of the first five books and I was like, oh, like I'm glad I, like it was fun. But the parts that like did kind of jump out at me as things that, and I do think that Rick Riordan has kind of, you know, adjusted and learned from criticism on this front. But the idea that the center of the world was Greece and now it's New York. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that kind of stuff, it's a little bit, it's less explicit, but it's a little bit more sort of insidious about, you know, just different ways that like, oh, like scary other people are depicted and things. Like, I think there's some of that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. not in the way that like we're rooting for Caesar to do a genocide or something, but right. like a somewhat more, I don't know, sneaky or like nuanced ways where it's stuff that I think maybe wasn't stuff that people in the mainstream were necessarily thinking about as much in the 90s, but that has gotten a lot more into kind of mainstream discourse now, of us thinking about like, oh, there's like kind of a lot of Orientalism going on in this, isn't there? Like, and I think that kind of stuff is there, but in some ways, like some of the casting choices and stuff feel very, people would be up in arms if you had like a Black Cleopatra on a main, you know, you made a Cleopatra movie and cast a Black actress, people would, there'd be a certain demographic really throwing a fit about that, that I don't think anyone cared when this episode came out.
And I was going to bring, this is somewhat related, I was going to bring in, but we were talking about the way people tend to want to sometimes appeal to like veracity or fidelity to some story, in a way that, in a lot of ways, that kind of mentality is just a mechanism for gatekeeping. And this is a classic example in like all the examples Amy just sort of listed of, you know, very often those kinds of arguments only get wheeled out in service of cordoning off some sort of part of history or mythology, usually for some kind of like construction of white identity. And I was just, this is, we're getting far afield, but I was sort of thinking of like, you know, what Xena is sort of doing and how it's playing very, you know, like Amy said, like you just kind of are taking this idea, a kernel of an idea, the sparagmos, taking a limb or a digit or whatever from a story and then telling your own story with it. I mean, all myths and all, and even like historical fiction does this, or dramas. Like I was thinking, like, nobody really complains about Kirk Douglas's Spartacus, even though that is, that sort of relationship to what we know about history and Spartacus is pretty tenuous, right? But we're going to take the Spartacus idea and use it to tell a left-wing populist story. People don't get as upset about that as they do about a Black Cleopatra, or like, I don't know if you saw Woman King, but there was a whole slew of articles coming out sort of surrounding that movie about the sort of historical reality that it's kind of based on. And like, Woman King sort of takes a lot of liberties with the story, and much of it is fabricated, but of like using this kind of thing to tell stories for the here and the now. And in some sense, I agree that like, yeah, like we're not beholden to, you know, veracity. And if we want to write a story where, you know, Caesar and Homer are contemporaries with one another, like,
fine. Having little buddy cop adventures where they go around the world and solve crimes as Caesar and Homer, you know.
I would watch that.
But I do think it is kind of interesting the way kind of all, you know, it's like everything from myth and history and Rome and Greece or whatever kind of gets like, it kind of gets squished together into like a single like capsule or something like that, and then we pull it apart. And so that's how you end up with this kind of story. That is sort of, it's relying on impressions rather than beyond that. Although occasionally, though, there is something that makes me raise an eyebrow. Like in, I think the, I have it in my notes, but like in season 2, episode 12, Destiny, where we first are introduced to Carl Urban's Julius Caesar, at one point he goes, Gaul is divided in three parts.
I know. Such a little Easter egg.
Truly. Yeah. I mean, somebody in the right, which, you know, for listeners at home, the very first words of Caesar's commentary on his wars in Gaul are Gaul is divided in three parts. And so somebody in that writer's room, you know. But yeah, I've already, I keep sort of, I'm really kind of meandering today. So
well, this makes me think of the one that you kind of sold to me, Colin, as the Ember Island players of this.
Oh, yeah.
So it was season 4, I think, the plays the
episode
thing.
22 or something.
Yeah, where I would say not necessarily Ember Island players from Avatar, but like it's the producers.
Yeah.
Like they oversell the investments. And they even say, I think Gabrielle says at one time, what, springtime for warlords? And I was like, oh my God, it's the producers. What is happening? So, but also I think the weird like through line of that story was very meta, in that it was talking about like, what do we like about the stories that we're telling? Like, is it the violence? And is it the fact that we are like wearing tiny suits of armor? And is it like, is it the sex and the blood? Or should we be saying something more meaningful? Like, do we want to promote violence? And I thought, I like didn't expect that to come from that episode, and it was kind of, it was such smart writing that like every episode I watch, I just, I'm like, this is so smart. like, however campy it is, it's so smart.
And like the conceit of that episode is basically, it's like modern. There's a couple of episodes that are like set in modern times, which I also love. That like in the universe of the show, Xena is simultaneously a show and also actual history. Because there's a part where a bunch of archaeologists dig up like the Xena scrolls.
Yes. Yeah.
But there's one where it's like it's so like in the now, you know, in the contemporary period, Ted Raimi and Lucy Lawless are a couple. And she keeps having visions of like her past life as Xena. And then they go to a therapist who's Gabrielle or Renee O'Connor. But then they sort of reveal the twist in the episode is that it's not Lucy Lawless isn't the reincarnation of Xena. It's Ted Raimi. He's the reincarnation of Xena. And Lucy Lawless is the reincarnation of Joxer. And at one point she's like, I'm Joxer. They should have never introduced that character. And then it turns out that Ted Raimi has been moonlighting as like a Xena vigilante. And it's just a lot of fun. But it's like, yeah, it's where this like the show is unconcerned, I think, to its benefit of cohesive inherent logic.
Speaking of, this just reminds me of how many of what are like very 90s TV show tropes we see that like I it was like kind of a weird nostalgia moment of, you know, like the color and the tone and like all of these things that are very 90s. And so much of like it has the musical episode that every single show had in the 90s. You have to have mm-hmm. a musical episode.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And they have they have a musical episode, and they have a lot of these things just, I mean, jump out at me as like, oh, there was an episode of like Star Trek DS9 that has, you know, where like maybe this whole thing is being written by a guy in the past, or maybe not. And like, you know, these kind of like, I just, a lot of these feel so familiar. And like, you know, Supernatural has the, yep. you know, where there's a musical about Supernatural that is, and yep. it's playing with all of like the fan fiction people are writing and mm-hmm. you know, talking about like subtext and all of these different, where it's like, yeah, you can see some of these tropes that don't necessarily, they aren't as tropey at the time, I don't think. Like, I don't think you necessarily recognize them at the time, be like, oh, this is a thing that every show does. But looking back, it's like, oh, that was such a marker of a certain like time and like genre of show.
Well, that brings me to like another aspect that's really kind of interesting to think about. I have the Wikipedia page up, and they pointed out that like Xena was originally like a three-part episode for the Hercules show, mm-hmm. and she was supposed to die in the third episode because she was a villain and she was a warlord.
She was supposed to die? I did not know that.
She was supposed to die. But she was so popular with the audience, they're like, no, we're going to give her an entire spinoff series.
And originally they were going to cast someone else. I think they were going to cast Vanessa Angel, I think is her name.
Yeah.
And then that fell through.
She was injured. I think it was that she was injured or sick or something, and they ended up casting, which like, you know, I mean, she's a good actress, but I can't imagine this show with someone who's not Lucy Lawless.
Yeah, no, it's actually, I was reading an interview of, it was like around the 15-year anniversary, and Lawless and Tappert and Renee O'Connor, who plays Gabrielle, were giving an interview. And basically the way Lucy Lawless describes it is sort of like she like really lucked into it. Like a lot of weird things happened where it was like the actor fell through, they had the show, she had been, I think she had played more than one person. She had been in a couple episodes of Hercules because that also was being filmed in New Zealand. And that sort of led into the Xena thing, or like her episodes in Hercules that led into the spinoff. And then eventually her show eclipsed Hercules in popularity.
and that's kind of like my question was like, what the hell was happening in the 90s? Like, if you imagine streaming services and popular TV shows getting canceled left and right, but like all of a sudden there's like, here's one random character in this one show that's kind of popular, and it's like, oh my god, she, like, everyone loves her, let's give her an entire series. That, what was it, it says 108 countries around the world have seen it since 1998. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was trying to think of some other 90s shows like Daria. Like, you get these really interesting representations of female characters that I don't think we'd seen as much before. And it's hard to imagine. I don't know. It's like, what's going on at this time? Like, how did this happen?
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, to say, and they talked about this in that interview of, you know, Xena is obviously kind of an early touch point for like female-led action roles, at least particularly mm-hmm. in television. But it was part of a kind of constellation happening right around the late 90s where you've got Buffy, you've got Alias. Mm-hmm. And Star Trek, you know, you got Voyager, and then Star Trek is a vehicle for a lot of sort of female. It's not solely, it's, you know, ensemble and mostly male, but yeah, it's, there were, I mean, I the 90s.
Oh, and you're getting, I mean, I think there's a lot of, I mean, this is going to go so far afield if we want to talk about like cultural movements and, you know, I mean, you're getting like the, yeah, I mean, you're getting like Riot Girl, you're getting like the Year of the Woman, like politically, you're getting women mm-hmm. who are, you know, holding elected office in a way that they hadn't before. Like you're just, I think you're getting a lot of, and like, yes, it's a simplistic sort of feminism in some ways that like mm-hmm. we could talk about, you know, it's a, like the mainstream kind of like feminism was very white, was very like, it was a very particular model of feminism, but it's also the time where we're getting strong female characters and, you know, these like strong female leads and mm-hmm. I don't know, even like your Ally McBeal kind of shows right. Yeah. where like, this is, you know, you're getting representation in a lot of ways that you just hadn't really seen before in a mainstream way. And I think this is very part and parcel. And like, I can critique limitations of this time and place of feminism, but I don't think I would have grown up with nearly the same, you know, you have the like US national team, the women's soccer team yeah. do it. Like, mm-hmm. oh, it's like you're
I wrote a book report about Mia Hamm when I was in fourth grade. I remember.
Yes. I probably had the same book that she, I remember having her book. I think that there was a real cultural movement around, and you're getting a ton of these like tomboy-ish, for lack of like a more refined or like precise term for what we're looking at. Like, it's like girls doing things that people told girls they can't do. And so, yeah, like you have a warrior princess who's
girls
out there.
Girls can be warlords.
Yeah, girls can be warlords. It's 1995 or whatever. Girls can be warlords too now. Come on.
Yeah. I think it's also funny that I was just sort of thinking like broad sort of cultural trends that it's happening particularly in television, where I feel like I'm also just thinking of this because Jennifer Lawrence sort of got into – I don't know if you followed this at all, but yeah. she said something to the effect that The Hunger Games was like the first female action star or something like that.
Which,
yeah, which would everybody, of course, kind of had a field day with like,
I
there were no women in movies.
I think she backtracked to say young adults, but
yeah.
like.
And I think like to give her the benefit of the doubt, I think what she was kind of getting at was that at least in like major blockbuster franchises, you did not really see young female action stars in that way. But to the point where, and like, sort of what I'm kind of getting at is that it, this sort of wave happens first in television, and it will be a few years before you see it, like Charlize Theron or someone like that, where like you could have a female led or an actress sort of really as an action anchor that is a box office draw or something like that.
Well, yeah, I'm wondering if I was just historically, if like this is the point that, you know, women in a generation have gained a lot more financial independence as well, and like where that might be showing up is on cable, like paying for cable. Yeah. So maybe they're just like, oh, we should create more content that women want to watch and consume. And because like slasher films had the same thing, like people created slasher films thinking like men were going to be obsessed with them. And then they're really surprised to find that like women, like young women are obsessed with slasher movies. So they're like, all right, let's make more.
Oh, and I think you, I mean, even, I mean, you start to have like women who have their own, like independently have money, mm-hmm. but also kind of a realization that even women who are still in like a fairly traditional, like they're staying home, but like they're doing the shopping. So if you mm-hmm. can, you know, in terms of advertising, which, you know, now we're in like a somewhat different model of how TV and movies, how the money works. But at the time, like, you know, you want to get women's eyes on your advertising. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm not a TV of the 90s scholar per se, but I mean, it sounds entirely plausible to me because, and this is, I was just looking at dates on like Kill Bill, for instance, and some of these things mm-hmm. where you're getting the higher profile women using swords and whatnot kind of movies yeah. are, you know, kind of lagging a little bit, yeah. you know, 2003 as compared.
Even like Alien, right? Like that's an Aliens, I guess, the second one, which is the real action movie is about motherhood in so many ways.
I was like, I was thinking about, but like that one's so, if we want to support Colin's argument here, that one
please,
makes it hard.
I love it when people do that.
No, I'm just saying like it makes it hard because like that's 79. Like that's right? such an early
yeah.
movie for like having a female protagonist who isn't, you know, your Leia, who is,
yes,
you know, the only woman in the galaxy as far as anyone can tell.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, like that's such an early female like action hero. Yeah. In Alien.
Mm-hmm. Well, they still try to in Xena, they still try to find line. Like not only so even though they call Xena and Gabrielle like soulmates, like every episode I watched, they had a different male love interest. Every time.
Yeah. Like, oh my God. Can we talk about the gender and sexuality like aspects here? Because I can't come on this and not like I got the mummy last time around. So.
Yeah, I was like gender and sex, nothing going on there. All right, moving on.
No, so this is like the other sort of serious.
No, we're like an hour in.
the other sort of thing that I think about a lot from a scholarly perspective is thinking about reception kind of through a lens of fan fiction as a, where you have, I could go on for hours about my thoughts on fan fiction, people writing themselves into stories and this and that. But this is a very early when we think about the ways that fan communities are shaping media. Like it's, Star Trek obviously is like one of the big ones with like Kirk Spock / Vic, where like, what if they were in a relationship? But that's something that's very, well, not very clearly, but like kind of like you have to do more work to pull that story out of it. Whereas here, and especially as the episodes go on, I remember there being a lot of people talking about, how like, I don't know, like, are they, aren't they? Rewatching it now, like, oh no, they are. They're in love.
100%.
100%.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, it's, it's a time where you still gotta like kind of tiptoe around things.
You gotta put Xena in a man's body or something like that. To,
yeah. Like there are limits to how much you can just be like, oh yes, these two women love each other in a romantic way, not just in a friend's way. But like, there's an episode where like Gabrielle's like getting kind of jealous because there's like this new girl who wants to be Xena's like assistant or like sidekick or whatever. And she's like, no, I sleep next to Xena. And like, oh, you're going to, that's just how normal friends are, that they get really possessive over who gets to sleep next to who. Like,
yep. Okay. Totally normal.
Yeah. They were just roommates. That's all.
Yeah.
But yeah. I feel like the online community around, like when you start thinking about like these early internet communities that are really like building communities around sharing, writing fanfic or like early vidding where people, at the time, like, now we have all this video editing equipment, but like the early vidding communities like are making VHS tapes and mailing them to people across the country because of the, like, we have these internet-based communities now that you can't send a video edit, like a mashup of something that like draws out the tension between them. So like, I'm gonna do some rudimentary editing on a VHS and mail it to my friend across the country so they can see the work I did and like the nuance in this relationship. And then I'm gonna send him a copy of my latest like fanfic that I wrote. And when we think about ways of kind of like mashing up, like, yeah, we can, I don't know, what if I write a story about Homer and Caesar and they're having adventures? Like that is a very, that sort of like people who work on fan fiction call this sometimes as being like a fanish affect. The story, like, here are my characters and I really like them. And what if I put them together? And it's not to sound like really dismissive, like, but it is kind of like taking your action figures from different sets and being like, now like Ken and G.I. Joe are going to go have adventures. Now they're going to kiss. It's a little like that same kind of like, what if I put these, and it's, it's genre bending. It's, there's a lot of, but classical literature has always had a ton of that. And thinking, what if we tell the story from this person's perspective? And what if instead of the story you thought you knew, it was a whole different story? And so I see like when, especially when people get real fussy about how like, oh, how dare you do this or that with this historical content? Like that's all, it's always been available for like, what is Dante doing, but writing like historical fan fiction with also like getting a couple burns in at the guys he doesn't like around town. Like it's the same impulse. And so I don't know. I just tend to have such a more like, this is in the tradition of Dante. Back off, guys. It's a perfect show.
No, I have two things that I noticed immediately in two of the episodes that I watched today. One was the one against the army, the Thermopylae marathon one where Gabrielle's wounded. She like gets a poison arrow and Xena has to like take care of her. And I think like the super interesting part of that story was it was like, save the world or save my best friend, air quotes. But she's like freaking out at the fact that Gabrielle might die. And I think they even say like, I love you. And there's like a moment that I was like, kiss. kiss, 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 kiss. They have this like lean in, and I was like, "Where? This is not subtext. This is text. I don't like."
Yeah.
And the second one was from the play is the thing, but at the very end, where like some of the actors who were them in the play come out, and they're like together, and it's like, if it weren't for you guys, we wouldn't have found each other. And I'm a thespian. And like,
I know. Oh, it's so subtle.
And it's like, oh my god, oh my god, it's like making fun of its own subtext that is actual text. I love it.
And I think like, the show, as the kind of show evolves, because I guess this interview that I was just talking about, where Lucy Lawless was saying that she's like Robert Tappert and the writers and the producers were like pretty cued into it, and they can, so like you get a lot of that kind of wink wink nudge nudge, and like they do have to kind of have a little bit of, they have a little bit of that plausible deniability because they're on like network television. But yeah, like it very much like sort of leans into its own reputation among fandom.
It's kind of like the last episode of Korra, where it's like her and Asami walk together hand in hand into the spirit world, and you're like,
and that becomes text. I mean, people are mad about that, but in the comics, they get into that.
Or my favorite that I see on like web comics is like, the ship has sailed. You're like, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, it has. Yeah.
All the ships.
But I love the fanfic sort of working itself back into the text. And I think of Virgil every time, because I'm like, the Aeneid is just Homer fanfic. Like there's nothing else about it. And it's also sort of writing itself into the text of like, yep, I see what I'm doing. And I have, you know, this half is the traveling around the world half, and this half is the siege half and the war half. And it's like, it knows exactly what it's doing. And it's so much fun. So much fun to see.
The thing that I love with like, once you start from, I mean, and it's such a running joke between Hellenist and Latinist being like, you know, all Roman literature is a ripoff of Greek literature, which I do tell my Latinist colleagues because it upsets them. But
I'm a little chafed.
I'm in a two-person department, and like my one colleague is like, he's the Latinist. And I insist on like, whenever I guest teach one of his classes, I insist on making sure everyone knows that it's just a ripoff. But yeah, they're using a lot of these stories in the same way, like all of Greek tragedy is Homeric fan fiction in a sense, right? But if you start like, okay, but how are they using it, right? Like, how, to what end did they make changes? Like, I can say, you know, is it because no one wants to see like an extremely nerdy scholarly treatment of this particular story where we make sure the timeline's right? Or is it because like, you know, I mean, my students were going to watch Disney's Hercules and talk about like the choices that you made there. And it's not interesting to be like, here's a list of 20 differences between the treatment that we see in Apollodorus and the treatment that we see in this movie. Yeah, like exactly. The interesting thing is like, okay, so like now that we know they made these choices, why? To what end? Do we agree with the end to which they put them? Is it valuable? Like, you know, I can say it's bad to make certain changes for X and Y reasons. Like I disagree with this choice because it elides very real violence that was there in the source version of the story. Like if we rewrite Apollo and Daphne as a love story, like, you know, we gotta think long and hard about the ethical balance of taking what is like sexual assault and turning it into a love story. Or, I mean, this comes up with Hades and Persephone. Not that you can't do things with these stories, but you need to be thoughtful about like, what is the effect? What is the, you know, to what end are we making these changes? And so I think like, yeah, it's a mashup of like, you know, Virgil's doing like both the Homer things. And kind of on some level, it's a pretty big flex to say, I can take all of Homer, I can do it in one work.
Yeah, right.
And I can do it, you know, about a civilization that conquered the world. Like, what did Greece do? Scoreboard, like Rome has conquered the world as we know it. And I can tell a story that does all of the Greek stuff some, right? Yep. And so like, yeah, I think when we think about that kind of fan fiction model, it's like, yeah, I'm writing myself into the story. And in a way that even like anachronistically, now when I read Homer, I'm thinking about like, I see Aeneas and I'm like, oh, snap, Aeneas, he's going to go on and do all this stuff. Like, no one would care about the scene where Aphrodite saves Aeneas if not for Virgil. Like, he has changed the source text in a meaningful way for readers because of his interventions. And like, that's a cool, like, to be able to have that effect that, you know, now when I go back to the source material that someone deviated from, they're there. Like the reception is there as part of the text now. Like, that's really cool. Oh, and that's so not, cool. You know, like that's an accomplishment. And I'm not saying every episode of Xena is, you know, rewriting my understanding of Homer, but, you know, when we think about these kind of like, when people are doing this kind of reception, like, I think it's more interesting to think about like, why, to what effect, to what end are they making these changes, as opposed to, you know, oh no, Thermopylae didn't happen after Marathon and whatever, like that, you know, that kind of like, no soldier could have possibly been running from Marathon. And why is a Persian soldier running from Marathon in the first place to tell Athens? None of this makes sense.
Right, right. Well, it just makes me think like Greek tragedies are Homeric fanfic with like contemporary political commentary. So like, what is our, what was the intended political commentary for making us like really root for Gabrielle and Xena to be together and happy and actual romantic soulmates? And I think that's a fantastic way to sort of see that lens of the subtext written back, sort of revisiting that, having sort of like seen the end almost and go back to the beginning.
Yeah. And I was thinking like, that's kind of the difference between gatekeeping source material versus letting people have fun with it, is like one's trying to be exclusive and have one single view and interpretation, and the other is inclusive. And I think that's in particular why Greek and Roman mythology and stories have always really resonated with queer identity too, because I remember sitting in my Greek civ class about a year ago and just asking, like, show of hands, is like, how many of you like loved Greek myth because you could see yourself in some of those stories? And it was really interesting that like just about every woman and person who I know identified as queer raised their hand, and like it was all the straight white guys who just kind of kept their hands down. And I was like, that's interesting. Like,
yeah.
Because you don't want to see yourself as Theseus, I guess, but
nope.
Well,
Jason or Hercules. I mean, no.
It's funny you brought up Theseus, because like Theseus is a great example. This is a different franchise entirely, but like honestly, Theseus in the Hades game has like recolored my understanding of Theseus. I mean, it was sort of there. Like it was. It's like I see it now, but like that's a perfect example of like reception can go back and affect. And then to your point, and even just one of the things that myth and fan fiction in particular is that fan fiction is, I think it's no accident that it is very popular among various marginalized communities, but especially queer communities, as a way to sort of, maybe I think part of the reason Xena has such a thriving fan community is because it's so amenable to that kind of approach. And it's an orthodox, or like it's a canon version versus a fanfic, if we can, you know, oversimplify into like two schools of thought, right? Does there need to be a canon? And a lot of popular franchises are really about canon. And I think particularly of like Star Wars has a very set canon despite its fan community, or like Harry Potter. There's a there's a lot of top-down canonizing coming from a franchise like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas Xena is like, it's very much sort of in connection with a fanfic community. If that was a coherent thought, which I'm not sure it was.
No, I think like, yeah, the idea, because part of what got me into thinking about like fan fiction as a methodology and looking at like modern fan fiction scholars as a way to think about classical reception, is that it is a place for people to say like, I kind of see myself in this, but making sub or like crumbs of a story into something. Mm-hmm. Like if you pull enough crumbs together, like maybe you have a snack that you can eat at the end of the day, right? As opposed to like, now we have way more texts than, I mean, just thinking about like American mainstream media culture. Now we have way more texts that have explicit queer representation. But for a long time, it had to be very winking. And, you know, there's where it was, if anything, like gesturing to a like an in-group of being like, no, this is for you, but we can't say it's for you. Like, you understand, mm-hmm. right? And so I think a text that, you had to work less hard to see yourself explicitly, like to see your sexuality in it, I think was something that maybe is lost on folks who are growing up now that don't quite understand like the dearth of representation there was. Mm-hmm. You know, now you can choose different queer, like what queer representation do you see yourself in the most? Whereas before, I mean, I know a lot of people who are like, you know, Ellen or like Looking or Queer Eye for, like, there were just like four things you could, you know, there just weren't a lot of choices, and you had to support whatever there was out there, or there might not be any more media that you saw yourself in. So you didn't get to be like, like, I'm not really a the L word kind of lesbian. Like, I'm more like a Xena. Like, there just wasn't enough choices to be able to think about where you, what actually represents the kind of person you are in your totality. It was like, well, if I want to see anything with like a gay character at all, I better love Will and Grace, because that's all I got. And yeah, I think that's like, as thinking about the legacy of this, that's just not something that, because there's been so much more content, like, I think is not as readily obvious that it was a big deal to have anything, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, with a ton of fanfic, like, it's something that allows people to see themselves. And you see that, I mean, you see this with a lot of like cosplaying too, of people being like, it'd be cool if this character that I love wasn't always like white or straight or able-bodied or whatever it is. And like, people able to physically like embody these kind of fanfic impulses of having costumes and taking on the role or writing their own fanfic or whatever, like, that it gives people that agency to put themselves into the story, which we all kind of do when we read stories. Like, we all kind of imagine ourselves on some level as like the protagonist or a character that speaks to us. But certain people have to learn to empathize across identity to consume media, and other people generally haven't been asked to do that so much historically. And so like, fan fiction is one of those places where it's this kind of democratizing impulse of giving people the agency to write themselves into these stories and not having to identify across gender and sexuality and race and a million other factors, because there is only one type of hero that we recognize in whatever canonical literature. Anyway, that felt like that got kind of heavy, and I wanted.
No, it's good.
No, I'm just thinking. I was like, "Damn, Amy, this is awesome."
This is great to be on the show.
Way to keep our podcast educational.
I never know how to file it. I have to put in the genre when I'm uploading it. I'm like, is it education or is it entertainment?
A little bit of both.
I do really want to make sure. There was one other thing about an episode that I just really wanted to make sure that we mentioned.
I was going to say, the thing we could possibly end on is just talking about favorite characters and or favorite moments in the show.
Okay, can I start with a least favorite moment? It just, it's so weird and I don't understand it at all. Okay, so there's an episode which is called, shows up a couple times. I think Lore of the Liar. No, Girls Just Want to Have Fun. So you have Bacchus, and then you have, again, like, I hate to, this is the place after being all about how like, we shouldn't be gatekeepy and this and that. The worshippers of Bacchus.
Bacchae.
Or Bacchae, but that is the singular form that they use. So it's a Bacchae. And it's just every time, like, my, just all of my, like, it should be a Bacchant or a, like, there's other, but like, Bacchae is plural. Every time. But like, so and I would encourage you to look up a picture of this, because it is wild. Okay. So Bacchus is he's like real devil, like just comical, like red, goofy looking devil. And then the Bacchae, which is both singular and plural, the Bacchae are vampires.
What? Yes.
Which, like, we're not. I mean,
Lost Boys was big then, right? Is that?
It's just, so here's the thing, like, why are we limited? They go hang out with the Morrigan. They, like, you could have there's no rules in this universe. Just make them vampires.
Yeah.
Or you could be like there's the Lamia, which you got to do a little deep cuts to like find a Greek vampire, but you could do that. And like, why is Dionysus is, he's drunk. He can be a little like chubby baby who's drinking a lot. He can be any number. Like, why would you pick this like ridiculous, like clearly devil, like devil, red, like plasticky red mask? And it's a wild, I have no, like, this is the one where I'm just like, I know I said this is a perfect show, but with an asterisk for, I don't understand what they were doing with Bacchus.
It's so weird.
It's so weird.
I wonder
it's
if they just so had like weird. What's that Tom Cruise movie, Legend or whatever, where there's like a devil character and he kind of looks like that. I wonder if they just had like the Hellboy makeup artist just had
It feels Hellboy. Yeah.
And I'm usually here explaining why, like, to me, Dionysus is like baby Jesus, because Jesus' first miracle is turning water into wine. And like,
yeah, I don't understand at all. They like, I don't know. I don't get it.
On that note, I have another one that like really crawled up my britches, but that is in the episode with, it's in season 3, I think. And it's the one, it's season 3 and episode 16, where like the premise of the episode is that Caesar has captured Vercinix, the leader of the Gauls.
Yeah, I just watched this episode. I have so many, like, I'm actually okay with every terrible decision in this episode, but please tell me what bothered you.
The one that I had like a little conniption was that we meet the other members of the triumvirate. So you've got Crassus, and I do kind of like what they did with that, with Crassus and the fast one that Xena pulls. But then we get Pompey, who introduces himself as Pompey the Magnus.
Yes, okay. That upset me. Pompey the Magnus did upset me.
And... oh man, and then he explains that it means magnificent or something
I thought that was intentionally like winking at it, because like they're like Pompey, like, and because I went back and forth. I was like, does this upset me for like legitimate reasons, or just like being pedantic reasons, or like, oh, I don't, that's not how what we say, because like, I mean, there's no like, it's weird to translate like the Magnus. Why? What? It's a weird choice, because like Pompey the Great is fine. I came down to I couldn't possibly justify that as being okay.
I mean, the true exposure for me is though I will often on this show sort of profess, you know, that everything is fair game and then within limits, but everything's fair game. You can do whatever. But at my heart, I am still a little bit of a pedant, especially when it comes to stuff like this.
Well, I will say, in someone's defense, I'm not sure whose defense this is in, but I do think the magnificent, like Magnus is like short for magnificent. I think they knew that they were being silly on that one. I don't know for sure that I wouldn't put a lot of money on that. But my instinct was, because they said that twice, I think they knew that was like a dumb catchphrase of like, like, I don't know. But I was
I
a little
like it.
Yeah. Like Magnus is short for magnificent. Like that feels like something that like Joxer or Autolycus would absolutely like throw out a dumb line like that.
Yeah. I feel like that's just like this sly little wink of like
Yeah. The choice of putting the in there is upsetting to me though. I will concede that.
Eli and Christy, any other big shout outs, bad shout outs, and then we can go to good shout outs.
Oh, there's so many things that I want to say. I really loved, it's in the beginning of the Marathon Thermopylae episode where Gabrielle tries to do Xena's famous flip. And she like is like trying to, she's like, I worked it out. Like I did all of the, she has like a little stick figure. She's like, like force.
Yeah, she did all the physics on it. Yeah.
But then she still messes up when she tries to do it without her staff. And she's like, no, my ankle is not broken. I'm just going to keep walking. It's fine. And I just love how all of that, like that entire character interaction seemed so perfect from these two characters, of Xena being like, I told you so, and like you do it on this foot, and I did it 300 times before I tried it this way. And she's like so serious about her like martial prowess, and Gabrielle's like physics. It was adorable and I loved it.
Let's see, I didn't watch quite enough to get too many hangups. I think the one that caught my attention was the second Cleopatra, when Xena is playing Cleopatra and some subterfuge is going on, and there's a conversation with Augustus about like, I just want to fix everything my dad did and do things for the people, which in the greater context of what maybe all of the Caesar episodes would have been about, like would have been his redemption arc story sort of thing. But I just was sitting here, I was like, that's not the Augustus I know and love.
Also, Carl Urban, just
I love fantastic.
Like that was gonna were like my favorite characters or whatever. I was like, it's it might be across the board Carl Urban, like as I really like the guy that played Ares also.
Yeah,
oh my god, he's like magically young, like his little facial hair, and he's just such a good like, and so. an episode that I insisted we had to watch all of. It's, oh my God, what is it called? Illusia. So they, Gabrielle and Xena die and kind of die. It's like, it's grief and mourning and they got to like work it out because like they were responsible for terrible things to each other's like children and whatnot. And anyway, I don't want to spoil things for people. There's like a lot of potential spoilers in there, but so they're like super mad at each other. And then it seems as though they die. It's a weird episode. And then this is the musical episode. And so they resolve all of their conflict in the land of Illusia, where Callisto is like this kind of wacky guide through this magical land where they're going to get redemption and reconcile and stuff like that. But Ares just shows up in so many like weird, just delightful bits where like, he's just so like episodes where there's one where like, Gabrielle is really sad and she goes to the temple of, and I mean, I don't blame them at all for whatever they came up with for the pronunciation. It's the Greek word for memory, which I can't ever say well at all.
Oh God.
Mnemosyne?
Yeah. So I always get really, I get really hung up on the MN part and
Mnemosyne.
And, but yeah, they say something like Mnemosyne, which is like a perfectly viable and way easier than every time I try and say this word ever. I like, and here are some muses and they're the daughter of, but she goes to this temple because she has like memories that are making her sad. And she's like really having a hard time. So she wants to forget these painful memories. And like Ares is her guy that accompanies her. It's like an embodiment of like her guilt or whatever, but like, he's just so sassy and so silly. And I love him so much. Everything about that actor, like that role, makes me very happy. So like him and Carl Urban are probably my favorite extra characters that aren't like the main, you know, Jocks are the Mighty with his little goofy theme song and Autolycus and stuff. But like outside of the main cast, I would say Carl Urban, and really like, I extra like him as Cupid, but I also like him as Julius Caesar. Like, he's a good bad guy as Julius Caesar. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Those are probably my favorite things. I'm trying to see. I have, like, so many episode tabs pulled up in the background. I just want to make sure there's nothing that I really – it was super important, needed to make sure I mentioned. But, yeah. Anyway, anyone who's listening who hasn't watched Xena, find some shadowy, dark corner of the internet where you can find these or buy them all on Amazon. Like, it's – it's such a good show. It's such a good show. I love it so much.
Christy, yeah. What do you? Oh, yeah, the animated. There's an animated movie, which we haven't mentioned.
Oh, I didn't know this at all.
Didn't either.
All
right. 1998.
Oh, my God.
I think I'm pretty sure actors. I watched this. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they really glammed up Kevin Sorbo there. Taking some liberties, but... I'll second the Carl Urban. He's great. Love him in the show. I am a fan. I do Ted Raimi. You know, the Ted Raimi is a certain type. Like that character, I think, is a character that is just was of a time, and we won't really get too many joxers anymore. But just the like goofiness and the ineptitude and all the hilarity of joxer.
Wait, can I show? There was one more moment I wanted to. Also, I've learned in an episode of. Maybe at the beginning of Hercules, or anyway, Lucy Liu, a very young Lucy Liu was in Hercules. I just was thinking about guest stars. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's awesome. I mean, she's always awesome, but there's an episode where Gabrielle gets like a magic scroll that whatever she writes in, it comes to pass. And so she writes, she doesn't know, like it's a magic, it's a whole thing, but she writes, it's just this like throwaway joke that runs through this whole episode about, she's like, Gabrielle woke up with a jerk. And this, because like she's like a magic bard or whatever. So anyway, Joxer the whole time is like, I don't understand. Like, how am I, what am I doing? And everyone else notices like she woke up next to Joxer. And he's the jerk. And like Ares shows up because like Ares and Aphrodite lose their powers as part of this whole shenanigans. And so like they both get it. Like everybody else, because they keep trying to like rewrite, like write things back to normal. And it keeps getting worse. And
classic bit.
Yeah, and everyone except for Joxer gets what's going on. Like, and he's reading it, and he's like, yeah, I just don't understand why I'm here. And people are just like, never mind.
I will say the one-liners that they would hit in these episodes are like, oh, that's good. I need to keep that somewhere.
They really are.
Smart writing. This is well written.
Any episode where Lucy Lawless just gets to be like kind of hammed up and just kind of really do like a real kind of like shit eating grin at the camera or something like that. Or
always when she's like, super into fishing, she's just like real. And there's a couple episodes where she's obsessed with fishing. It's great. It's so much fun.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, this was delightful that we got to watch Zeno. Thank you for coming to chat with us about Zeno.
Yeah, thank you for giving me such a good excuse to buy every episode. I'm like, haven't finished my rewatch yet. And it's been such a, like, it's just hours of delightful. Like, it's a good thing I can do, like, while answering emails or like grading Greek quizzes. I can, I can watch like hijinks and shenanigans.
Okay. To that end, Amy, as we wind down, is there anything you want to plug in particular or any place that people can find you on the internet or elsewhere that a listener should be aware of?
Mostly still on Twitter until that poor cursed hell site eventually completely goes away, at Apistone on Twitter. And I am currently, I don't know when things will come out whatsoever at all, but I'm currently working on an edited volume coming out of a conference on Receptions of Sappho. And at some point there will be a volume on Receptions of Sappho. Speaking of most, not all of it, but there's a lot of real like queer sapphic stuff in there. So if you were like, oh, I love that relationship between Xena and Gabrielle. I don't know for sure that there's any mentions of Xena in this volume, but we also haven't written all the chapters yet, so I can make sure there are some in mine.
Nice.
My chapter is about an imaginary, a completely fictional friend of Sappho's called Bilitis, who somebody made like a forged set of poems and pretended it was her, and it upset a lot of German philologists. And it's stay tuned for Les Chansons de Bilitis, the songs of Bilitis and its legacy among early lesbian political activist movements in the United States.
Oh, all right. I can't wait.
I mean, on academic publishing timelines, who knows? Like in 5 years, you might be able to read about it or whatever it is. Great. But at some point, this volume will hopefully come out.
Oh, yeah. I got a thing about that. We'll come back. But in the meantime, I will sign us off. So thank you all for listening. As usual, you can find us on moviesvedig.com, and you can find our episodes on most major streaming services. Thank you, Amy, again so much for coming on. We hope you had a good time. And we will see you around the bend. Bye.
Bye.
And today, we're chopping up Xena, Warrior Princess, an American fantasy television series that ran from 1995 to 2001, created by Robert Tappert, RJ Stewart, and Sam Raimi, and starring Lucy Lawless. And today, we have a very special guest to talk to us about this show. Oh no, do I need to stop?
It's Robert Tappert. That's a typo on my
part. I was wondering about that. I was like, oh, what an interesting name.
It's like, I know there's a rover out there.
I mean, good work on the fly. I was like flipping over until like I have the Xena wiki up and I was like, is it Rover? What an interesting name. Is he French?
No. That's what, that was what I leaned towards. I'm like, I'm just going with it.
Yeah, right. Robert. I think that's Robert.